In other words, after seeing Europe firsthand, they began to see Russia as they had never seen it before, to understand its limitations and to desire to overcome these. Thus, when Turgenev returned to Russia in 1812 after his studies at Göttingen, he wrote the following in his diary. I quote in translation, "I've been back for 3 weeks already, and still I'm out of my mind. Ignorant faces on which you see the marks of servitude, coarseness, and drunkenness make me suffer and frankly wish to return to foreign lands. The lack of enlightenment among the upper classes only intensifies this desire. As the years passed, these feelings didn't go away." Especially when he thought about serfdom, which he openly called slavery. A quote from 1818. "I used to sit on my balcony in the mornings and enjoy a smoke." By the way, he had a lovely house, a large house sitting on the embankment of one of Petersburg's canals. "I used to sit on the balcony in the mornings and enjoy a smoke, but now even this simple pleasure has been spoiled by thoughts of slavery. Working in the highest bodies of government, as I indicated he did, only deepened his despair." He wrote the following in 1820 about his colleagues in the very important and influential State Council. "I foresee nothing good to come from the council. I have hope in Count Miloradovich, half hope in Count Kochubey, one quarter hope in Prince Galitzin. As for the rest, what can one expect from those automatons composed of mud, hair powder, gold braid, and personified meanness, stupidity, and egoism? They looked European, but in their souls, in their spirits, in their values, they were not." Western Europe, in other words, had opened his eyes to Russia, and the sight of it made him suffer. His eyes were also, of course, like that of his friends, opened by education and books. The first years of the 19th century, even more than the century that had preceded it, was a time of enormous intellectual and cultural ferment, all of which had a great impact on Turgenev and his friends. There was expanding educational opportunities, especially higher education, publishing, imported books, public lectures, and most importantly, there were places for thoughtful, young, educated Russians to meet and talk, this public space. There were cultural circles. They were often called, with the Russian word Kruzhki or Kruzhok, literally means a circle. And this tradition became very important in the later history of the intelligentsia as a place to gather and talk and think. There were Masonic lodges. There were various literary organizations. And where the talk was about literature, it was often really about life. And eventually, underground political organizations, such as the ones Turgenev helped to organize in St. Petersburg. The Union of Salvation, formed in 1816. A union of welfare that emerged out of that in 1817. And finally, the still more secretive, still more political Northern Society established in 1821. These were places where young Russians like Turgenev looked for a meaningful way to live their lives and to serve their country. In their thinking, men like Turgenev were very much children of the 18th century, of the Enlightenment. They were rationalists. They were humanists. They were humanists in the sense that they despised the conservative view of human beings as essentially evil, fallen creatures. For them, every human being is endowed with reason. And this meant that every human being had the power to create a better world and also deserves a life of dignity and respect, whatever their origins, whatever their social status. They all were endowed with the same natural, God-given wisdom, reason. Needless to say, they hated Russian serfdom, really slavery, as Turgenev called it, for nothing better exemplified the way in which ordinary Russians in Russia were degraded, were treated as if they had no human dignity. In fact, in their view, the entire Russian system of autocracy and aristocracy and serfdom degraded people beneath the top. They were also, as I said, rationalists. They believed passionately that the world is malleable, that societies and political structures and people could be changed according to the dictates of reason. And this rationalism shaped their political ideals. And none of them wanted the masses to rule. They were too irrational. Instead, they looked to a strong state as the best hope for change. A state, though, that would be led by rational leaders, by wise individuals. It's not surprising that one of Turgenev's greatest political heroes was Peter the Great, a man who used reason to force Russia, not gently, but decisively, into Western civilization. And he deeply hoped that Alexander I would be like the great ancestor, like Peter the First, and even better. There was also something more than 18th century humanism and rationalism in their ideas. In many ways, like many educated Europeans of the 19th century, they were romantics. They were, in the one sense, romantic nationalists. They believed it was their sacred mission as enlightened individuals to save Russia from its backwardness. Hence their first society called the Union of Salvation. And most of all, they had a typical romantic view of the individual. They dreamed of a society in which everybody would be able to realize their full potentialities. They also wanted to live their own lives with meaning, with some higher purpose, not just as the aristocracy seemed to live typically for personal benefit. They wanted to act in a romantic and a heroic way. They wanted to do something for the world that would ennoble them, ennoble their soul, in the truest meaning of the word. And ultimately, this is what happened on Senate Square, beside the statue that Catherine the Great built to honor Peter the Great. This is what happened on December 14th, 1825. This was an effort for all its terrible organization, for all its tragic and pointless outcome, an attempt at least to bring with force, but Peter also used force, to bring about an enlightened state for Russia, one that would ensure civil rights and dignity for all people. But it was also a heroic moment. It was a moment of standing up heroically, at least in theory. In practice, it didn't turn out that way, by a small number of individuals who at least declared before the moment they were ready to die if necessary in order to say that Russia needed to change. Now, in this light, let me offer a few concluding words about Decembrism in Russia. It should be clear that what most offended men like Turgenev was the terrible contrast between what ought to be their ideals from books, from experience in Western Europe, and what was, what they could see before their very eyes. They believed in rationality. They believed in the rule of law. What they saw was personal and arbitrary government, inspired more by prejudice than reason. They believed in the natural dignity of all human beings, the importance of personal self-fulfillment. What they saw was that the majority of Russians lived in what amounted to slavery. And even for the elite, their freedoms were often restricted. Their rights were restricted in so many ways. They wished Russia to be respected in the world as a Western, civilized society. Instead, they saw at best Russia was feared in the world as a mighty, martial, political force, and often by many viewed with contempt, something they knew very personally from their time in Western Europe, where it often pained them, as it pained Turgenev when he was at college in Göttingen, to hear the way Europeans spoke about Russia as a savage land filled with bears, filled with a backward society. Symbolically, and really tragically, this contrast between ideals and realities was apparent on the very day that this movement suffered its worst blow. On July 13th, 1826, five of the Decembrists, as indicated, were to be taken out into a public square beside the great Peter and Paul fortress and, before a crowd, hanged. The chairs were pulled out from under their feet, and at this moment, three of the victims, after hanging briefly in the ropes, slipped through the knots and fell to the ground. Before they were strung up again, one of the condemned Decembrists, a man named Sergei Muravyov Apostol, whose legs were broken by his fall, remarked, in words that in many ways might serve as a sort of epigram for much of Russian history, he said, "My God, they can't even hang men properly in Russia." Next time, we'll look at a ruler who came to power amidst this rebellion. The man many feared, and indeed with good reason, was determined to set back the clock on reform in Russia. And this was Emperor Nicholas I.
Lecture 9, Nicholas I, Orthodoxy, Autocracy, Nationality.
As you already may have noticed, a certain pattern has begun to emerge in the history of modern Russian politics. Reform, in particular efforts to make Russia more European in its cultural and political and social life, tended to alternate with doubts, hesitation, uncertainty, conservatism in policy, and even a form of open reaction. Sometimes we see this alternation in policies between regimes themselves, often personified in the rebellion of children against their parents. So, for example, Catherine the Great, we've seen, undid many of the acts of her overthrown and murdered husband, Peter III. Paul I tried to undo a great deal of what had been accomplished by his mother, Catherine II. And in turn, Paul's son, Alexander, tried to undo what his father had done and continue the work of his grandmother. No less often, though, and sometimes even more interestingly, we see the work of individual rulers, within the work of individual rulers, hesitation, vacillation, doubts, even a turn from reform to conservatism. We saw this, for example, to some degree in Catherine the Great's reign. We saw it in the reign of Alexander I as well, where growing doubts led to a desire to pull back from some of the talk of major reform that we saw at the beginnings of their reign. And we see the same pattern again when Alexander's younger brother, Nicholas, took the throne in 1825. Of course, his conservative attitudes were likely made more intense by the circumstances under which he came to power, namely an open insurrection by liberal, westernized nobles against autocracy and against its social foundation, serfdom. Clearly, at this moment, the dangers of reform, the dangers of liberal ideas even, had never been clearer. And this lecture will focus on the reign of Nicholas I from 1825 to 1855, and above all about his ideas about power and order and reform, the ideas that inspired him and his policies. Let me begin with what's most visible, namely Nicholas's policies, and also to some degree how these were viewed by his contemporaries. People who knew Nicholas, who observed Nicholas personally, generally agreed that he was exceptionally ruthless as a man and as a ruler. They often spoke of his personal harshness, his outbursts of rage, his obsession with regimentation, with discipline, with order, with militarism even. In many ways, he was a classic Grozny Tsar, this fierce and awesome Tsar tradition that I've talked about. In a lot of ways, in fact, he was reminiscent of his grandfather, Paul I. And this emphasis on order, especially on ruthless order, can be seen also in his policies. On the one hand, it's worth noting it had its, as it often had, a positive, even a progressive side. He undertook a major codification of the laws, which was finished in 1835. This was the first codification since the great Ulugenia of 1649 of Alexei, of Peter the Great's father. For the first time since then, though remember, Catherine the Great talked about doing all of this, all the various laws with all their inconsistencies were brought together and made rational and orderly. He also tried to improve the conditions of state peasants, the peasants who belong to the state as opposed to those who belong to private landlords or to the church or personally to the crown. And there were some important improvements. He gave more land to peasants to use. He provided schools for peasants to try to improve conditions. And he even allowed more self-government, more self-administration in the lands of, in the villages of state peasants. In foreign policy, we also see this obsession with order, sometimes ruthless order. Nicholas I engaged in an unceasing struggle throughout his life against revolution and indeed liberalism of any form, since in the 19th century revolution often was of a liberal nature in many ways. Wherever he saw revolution, in Europe as well, he wanted to fight against it in his foreign policy. He was determined to defend traditional monarchies and, I should say, traditional social orders anywhere he found them against the rising tide of democratic and even social revolution in Europe. He made plans, in fact, in 1830, a time in which revolutions were breaking out in France and other places, but especially in France. He made plans to actually send Russian troops all the way across the continent into France to try to defend the traditional government and suppress this rebellion. He was distracted by a greater problem in his own front yard, namely a rebellion in Poland, which had become part of the Russian Empire since Catherine II, a rebellion in the name of independence, national independence, but also a democratic order. This was a more immediate concern, and that's where he sent troops instead. In 1848, when an even greater wave of revolution swept across Europe, Russia did in fact actively intervene in some of these revolutions, especially those nearer at hand in Eastern Europe, in particular in Moldavia and in Hungary. These interventions of Russia into the politics of Europe earned him, on one hand, a certain admiration, especially from governments like Austria, very happy to have him help them put down the uprising in Hungary. But in the eyes of liberal democratic Europeans, educated Europeans who existed in large numbers, he became known as the gendarme of Europe, a man determined to intervene in the name of traditional power. We also see at home similar efforts regarding intense imposition of order in his own domestic policies. Parallel to his foreign policy, we can see this in what is often described as Russification policies throughout the empire, in particular, of course, in troublesome Poland. This meant efforts to impose Russian language, Russian culture, on all the various peoples of the Russian Empire, integrate them, make them think they're Russians, make them try to forget about their desire to have nations of their own, and crush any signs, of course, of nationalism among many of these various groups. This was seen as essential to order, to unity, to discipline in the empire, though the practice, the effect of all of this, was only to increase resistance even more. He was also known in his policies, again, and a reflection of this desire to impose order everywhere, for enormous cultural repressiveness. Remember, we've talked about the cultural ferment and change in Russia in the late 18th and into the early 19th century. He tried to stop it where he could. In education, for example, teachers, students, lectures, books, all became suspect, had to be submitted to the government and approved in advance, and were kept under very close supervision. And only officially approved views, approved in advance, were to be allowed in the classroom. In fact, there's one famous story where Nicholas I is riding in his carriage, going by St. Petersburg University, which, as you remember, Alexander I had really created into a truly modern liberal arts type of university. And he says, "Stop the carriage there, driver." And he looks up at the university and he says to his companion, "You know, in there is a wolf's den." And he was determined to root out these wolves wherever he could find them. Censorship, the press, was another wolf's den, in his view, became much more restrictive than it had ever been before. An elaborate oversight bureaucracy was created to make sure that unacceptable views were not to be heard. Even science was put under tighter controls. You never knew what scientific ideas might undermine tradition, especially religious tradition. In fact, many began to speak about the fact that Nicholas had created what amounted to what we would not later call a police state in Russia. And in some ways, this notion that Nicholas created a police state is literally true. He established a special police agency called the Third Department of His Majesty's Own Chancery. And the initial purpose of this institution, this Third Department, was to avoid a repeat of the Decembrist Rebellion. But it became a very wide-ranging force in the following years. It was, first of all, entirely secret and entirely personal. It functioned outside of all law except the emperor's will. And its agents, who were dressed in these rather ominous-looking sky-blue uniforms, became a pervasive presence in especially urban areas in Nicholas I's Russia. They sought out dissent, opposition, nonconformity, wherever they could find it, and suppressed it. And I should add that in addition to this, these formal agents, the Third Department created a network of civil reform, informers, people, ordinary citizens who would be hired by the Third Department to inform on their friends, on their neighbors, on their co-workers, even children were included as informers to inform on the adults in their midst. The purpose of this Third Department was very broad. In the words of one sympathetic conservative Russian historian writing in later years, he said, the government had to know what was going on among the people. What were their thoughts? What did they talk about? What occupied them? It became necessary to penetrate right into people's hearts and most secret thoughts. You can see why some people have suggested that this Third Department was foreshadowing already 20th century totalitarianism in the determination to gather information at the very depths of society and the determination to control what was seen as pervasive threats and disorder. Now, the revolutions of 1830 and 1848 made Nicholas's already emerging police state even more rigid. And I should note that he was also convinced by the revolutions that he was right. He was right to be so strict and brutal. After all, apart from Poland, but Poland was new, Poland wasn't controlled as well, it was more distant. Apart from the uprising in Poland in 1830, Russia was spared these upheavals. And Nicholas was convinced that Russia was spared the revolutions, especially of 1848, precisely because he was so ruthless. And he blamed these events, these revolutions, on government's weakness, on their vacillation, on their playing with liberal reform. And he wasn't averse to writing to various monarchs in Europe to tell them they need to be tougher just like he is. He was determined, of course, not to make the same mistake. Now, it should be noted, before concluding this discussion about his image and his policies, that many people greatly admired Nicholas I. Contemporaries who met him invariably commented on not just his brutality as a ruler, but his imposing physical presence. He was 6'3" tall, and also on his magnificence, even his physical beauty. Typical, for example, is this description by a diplomat from the United States, Andrew White. Nicholas I, he said, was a most imposing personage and was generally considered the most perfect specimen of a human being, physically speaking, in all of Europe. Colossal in stature, with a face such as one finds on a Greek coin, but overcast, with a shadow of Muscovite melancholy. With a bearing dignified, but with a manner not unkind, he bore himself like a god. Whenever I saw him, there was forced to my lips the thought, you are the most majestic being ever created. And in fact, many contemporaries like to compare him to a Roman god, usually Jupiter, by the way. Now, these images of Nicholas as brutal gendarme or majestic Jupiter are both parts of the truth, but still only superficial parts of the picture for understanding Nicholas and his reign. There's also a sort of what might be described as a greater complexity, even in his personality, that complicates matters, that complicates his motives and understanding him. First, there's considerable evidence that Nicholas's brutality and ruthlessness and obsession with order reflected not so much bold and brave confidence as fear, a fear that almost verged on panic. Revolution, for example, we know obsessed him. When he learned of outbreaks of revolution in 1830 and 1848 in Europe, he reacted with an outburst among those around him of panic, of fear, of anger. People were shocked at how excited he got about it. It seemed to be an obsession with him. This, of course, was not new. The Decembrist revolt was always a preoccupation of his. He personally participated in the investigation, personally interrogated many of the accused, and tremendously was wrapped up with remembering this terrible event throughout his life. More generally, people noticed a remarkable obsession, which many say extended well beyond reason, with regimentation, with discipline, with orderliness, with neatness, with precision. People said clearly there was something more than politics here. There was something about personality, rooted, many believed, in a pervading fear of disorder of any sort. Now, other traits of his personality are worth mentioning, for they further complicate this picture. One is that Nicholas I was a deeply religious man, though it's worth noting that his religiosity was not like that of many educated Russians of his time, including Alexander I, at least in his last year. This wasn't restless searching for the meaning of life, for deep mystical truths. It wasn't even the sort of modern religion that we saw among, for example, the Decembrists, the belief that reason was a divine attribute. In his words, these are what he said often, "I believe in the manner of a peasant, unquestioning, simple, faith, absolute, not inquiry." He was also known for a truly remarkable moral harshness that grew out of perhaps his fear and anxieties of disorder, but also out of his peasant-like faith. For one thing, despite his faith, he could forgive no one. As he pointed out, "Christ shall forgive, not me." In fact, even his greatest admirers were amazed by his absolute harshness toward offenders, toward sinners of all sort. He seemed to have a deep need to cast blame, and he couldn't forgive. Just as an example, he carried this so far as to even punish a physical object that he believed had sinned. In this case, a warship. This was during the war with the Turks in 1828, 1829, and a great frigate named Raphael had surrendered to the Turks. Nicholas issued in response to this news of this surrender an edict. He said that it's necessary to, quote, "wash off the shame brought upon the fleet and indeed Russia itself by this surrender." He said, "I consider, quote, this frigate to be unworthy in the future to fly the flag of Russia." And he ordered the admiral to burn the ship. Further complicating his political personality, the personality that shaped policy in so many ways, he cultivated an image as a family man. For the first time in Russia, one sees wide publication of images of the Tsar and his wife and his children, and very sentimental images. And he had a very sentimental persona for the public, almost a middle class, a bourgeois ideal of family life, loving and close and ordinary. And I should say this wasn't just a public image for public consumption, though it was partly that. We know that he personally cultivated with his family a very idyllic image of personal life. And this was most evident in the creation of a nice little cozy family retreat in a special mansion that was built for his family at Peterhof. He didn't want to be in this big, grandiose palace there. He wanted his own little cozy, sort of Western bourgeois family home. It was designed appropriately by an English architect. It was designed in the Gothic style, seen as cozy in those days, and he called his house, in English, the cottage. And according to one recent historian, this whole idea of a cozy Gothic house was to express the goal of, in this historian's word, sequestered private life set aside from the noisome everyday world. This was indeed Nicholas's ideal. Now, in all these aspects, religion, morality, family life, you can see a particular cultivation of the idea of the ruler as virtuous. In other words, very much in the Russian tradition of the Tsar as not only Grozny, mighty and awesome, but also loving and pious and gentle, the Tishaishi Tsar we've talked about. Now, these questions of personality are obviously important in Russia, as we've seen, and this was especially true under Nicholas. Political power in Russia remained very personal, based on powerful individuals still much more than on laws. But what's also interesting about these years is for the first time one sees an articulation of a full-blown ideology of Russian politics, worked out by various associates of the Tsar, though they were very close to him, by conservative writers and intellectuals, and indeed these ideas fit the way Nicholas, who could never articulate it with this sophistication, but the way he really thought about Russian power. The importance of this formulation of official ideology, in fact, is so great. It was, by the way, called official nationality. At least later historians gave it this name. One can't underestimate how important these ideas were, not just for Nicholas I's reign, though they characterize it perfectly, but would remain in some ways the ideology of the Russian state to the very end, all the way to the end, to the reign of Nicholas II. And indeed, one could argue that one could see these same ideas even in Soviet communist politics as well, and maybe even today. There are three key ideas here: orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality. Let me briefly consider what's at stake here. And by the way, the order never changed. And the classic formulation of these ideas was by the Minister of Education, whose job it was, in part, to talk about what should be taught in schools. What is the culture, the values of this society? The guy's name was Sergei Uvarov. And he did this in 1833, first in a circular sent to all the local education officials in the country, in which he expressed this ideal rather clearly. His words: "Every professor and teacher shall become a worthy instrument of the government and educate the people in the unified spirit of orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality." And Uvarov repeated these principles on numerous occasions, and many began to echo him clearly. Magazines and newspapers declared this trinity of orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality to be an article of faith, and often made use of it. These essential ideas pervaded public discussions by the government, by its supporters, in church sermons, in schools, and a good deal of state policy as well. And these ideas are interconnected, but let me take each of them in turn. First of all, orthodoxy, in Russian, pravoslavia. In many ways, this assertion of religion was a reaction to the dominant convictions of the Age of Reason, which had preceded Nicholas already for quite some time and informed that of many of his predecessors. Official ideologists made it clear that they completely rejected the prime place that was given by so many to human reason, to human capacities. For example, the very influential and conservative historian and journalist named Mikhail Pogodin, quite close to the crown, stressed in his writings the mystery and unfathomableness of life, the absolute inability of the human mind to grasp anything about the way the world worked, and therefore the complete vanity of science and reason. This philosophical stance, this reliance on faith rather than reason, had very practical and quite conservative implications for politics. First, there's no point in believing in the perfectibility of human society, such as inspired the Decembrists, or even Alexander I, early in his reign. Humans were simply not capable. One must leave making life better to God. And in fact, probably it would only be better in heaven anyway. Not unlike the ideas we saw with Alexander I toward the end of his reign. Most of all, these ideas justified, in fact, sanctified all existing authority as coming from God. People must leave earthly government to those God has sanctified, to those God guides, namely, royal authority, divine authority. It was always said, for example, in the coronation ceremony, that the heart of the Tsar is in the hand of the Lord. This was repeated each time a new monarch was crowned, and this was understood almost literally as a special, unique bond between God and the Tsar. No less, all social authority existing was sanctified. Lords over serfs, officers over soldiers, employers over workers. Everyone, it was said again and again, must serve God in his own place. If you were born under authority, it was said, that's where you should remain. That's the divine order. That's what orthodoxy means. At the same time, of course, this wasn't just a justification of authority per se, as it existed. To be truly sanctified authority, it was assumed that your power should also be in the spirit of God's will. It should be Christian authority. It should be virtuous. It should be tishaishi. Now, the connection of all this to the idea, the second part of this trinity, autocracy, samodzherzhavye in Russian, should be obvious. Like all earlier monarchs, autocracy was viewed as sacred, autocratic rule, as willed by God and sanctified by God and guided by God. At the same time, and hence that this term stands alone, autocratic rule was viewed, as it often had been before, as absolutely necessary, as good. In part, this was a negative argument. Human beings, contrary to the ideas of the Age of Reason, are inherently weak, even wicked, basically sinners at heart. Fairly typical, for example, was the view one found in by one of the leading newspaper publishers of the time, one of the leading writers, a man named Nikolai Gretsch, who said that humankind was, his words, a despicable and ungrateful tribe. To keep order in the face of such a humanity, what one needed was the strong hand of government. As this was put by another influential contemporary journalist, a man named Fadyei Bulgarin, he said, "It is far better to unchain a hungry tiger or a hyena than to take off from the people the bridle of obedience to authorities and laws." Now, having said all this, let me add that one should be careful of oversimplifying all of these ideas. For this was also a positive political argument about autocracy, as we've seen before to some degree. Autocratic power was not only necessary for order to chain the wild hyena, as it were, but also the best means for ensuring progress and even a happiness. The state was to be not only mighty and controlling, but also an engine of progress. It was to be caring. It was to be beneficial, paternalistic, united truly in love with the nation and the people. And in fact, again and again, the Russian polity was described publicly as a family. This analogy was very often explicit. And in this family, the Tsar was the father, stern but benevolent. The Tsar Batushka, he was called, the Tsar father. And people, including the nobles, were children, obedient, loyal at best, needing discipline, even punishment, when appropriate. And this ideal can be seen reflected throughout the entire system at the time. Military commanders were told to be fathers to their soldiers. Landlords were told to be fathers to their peasants. Industrialists should be fathers to their workers. This brings me to the third component of this official nationality, really in some ways the most puzzling and debated of the three, the notion of nationality, narodnost, in Russia, which basically meant the special nature of Russia and of the Russian people. Now, in part, this was simply the reverse side of autocracy. This was a view of the Russian people as special, as somehow uniquely loving and obedient subjects of the Tsar and the landlords and all those in authority, as really specially made to be children, loyal, obedient, but also childlike in their lack of self-control and their need for a strong hand and loving guidance. This notion of the special nature of the Russian people as fitting so well in this paternalistic system was certainly a view shared by Nicholas I. A typical example. Nicholas liked to tell the story of how in 1831, when there was a minor military uprising, but a threatening one, the ordinary soldiers were not against him personally, just against the abuse of certain officers. And he described how he rode right there amidst the troops that were rebelling in order to personally quell it just by his own presence. And these are his words, often repeated. "Observe that except for Orlov and Chernyshev," these are two high officials who were there, "I was absolutely alone among them. And they all lay flat, their faces to the ground. Ah, that's the Russian people for you." And he told other stories during great cholera riots in St. Petersburg. He did the same thing, rode out into the mad crowds, and his presence alone inspired them with love and devotion, and the riot suddenly ended. "There's the Russian people for you," he says. These ideas, of course, have their roots in European thought of the day. There was a widespread notion throughout Europe, including Russia, that every nation had its own particular unique genius, its distinctive history, institutions, language, temperament, views. Russia's genius, it was widely believed, at least by those who articulated this official ideology, was that unique bond between czar and people, that special relationship of love and devotion, such as you'd find in no other country, and indeed was the strength and salvation of Russia. On the other hand, many Russians began to feel that this sort of talk was archaic and dangerous, simply not suitable for a modern state trying to exist in the modern European world, where institutions were there to represent people's interests, where there were mediating forms of power. And as we'll see, this ideology and opposition to this official nationality would be one of the main ideas, one of the main conflicts tearing apart Russian life in the 19th and early 20th century, leading to crisis and even revolution. Next time, we'll look at a man who in many ways in his life felt and even embodied many of these tensions, and embodied them as well in his very widespread, loved, influential writings. And this is Alexander Pushkin, a man who became known as Russia's national poet for the ways in which he defined even the meaning of Russia and the meaning of what it meant to be Russian.
Lecture 10, Alexander Pushkin, Russia's National Poet.
In this lecture, I look at a single individual, a poet and a writer, whose life and whose work in many ways became, especially after his death in 1837, as important to the definition of what it meant to be Russian, indeed what Russia was as a nation, as any monarch. Indeed, one might say, probably more so. Indeed, even many Russians today would still say that the life and work of Alexander Sergeyevich Pushkin, who lived from 1799 to 1837, partly defines what Russia is and what being Russia is all about. Now, I'll come back to this question of Pushkin as a symbol of the nation. But first, I want to talk something about the man himself and his work and, of course, his tragic death. I should make clear that this isn't a literary analysis of Pushkin's writing, his poetry, or his short stories. Rather, I'm looking at Pushkin with a historian's eye, at Pushkin as a cultural figure, at a person who reflected in many ways and fit in to his cultural world, as well as helped shape that cultural world. And in particular, what his life and how people talked about him tell us about Russia in the early 19th century, and especially at emerging notions of Russianness, ones that weren't exactly the same as Nicholas I's notion of narodnost, of nationality. In many ways, and this is really characteristic of the whole story, Pushkin was at the same time a privileged insider and a rather difficult outsider to Russian life. He was born in 1799 in the city of Moscow into a very aristocratic family that on his father's side could trace its lineage all the way back to the old Muscovite nobility. And this was a great matter of pride for him. As he liked to say, the names of my ancestors are met with in every minute of our history. He was clearly proud of this. His maternal lineage was actually even more interesting and complicating the story of who he was as a Russian. His great-grandfather was named Ibrahim Hannibal. He was an African. And according to the family legend, Hannibal was the son of an Abyssinian prince held hostage in the court of the Turkish Sultan, who was then taken back to St. Petersburg and given by a Russian envoy as a gift to Peter the Great. This was in 1705. The Tsar, who always loved curiosities, decided to make this African boy his godson and sent him to France for military training. Europe and military, two things Peter considered very important. And eventually, Hannibal ended up being a great general in the Russian army with large estates, all given to him by the crown for his services. And this heritage, too, is part of Pushkin's peculiar and complicated self-image. Partly this was negative, Pushkin was sometimes taunted for his African heritage, and in fact, for his visible African features, curly dark hair, full lips, African-looking nose. And echoing these attitudes, he himself sometimes hated this heritage. At one point in a poem, he described himself as a hideous descendant of Negroes. But this exotic ancestry was also a source of a particular sort of pride. The pride of being unique, of being an exotic outsider, of being something special. For example, in his novel in verse, Eugene Onegin, Yevgeny Onegin in Russian, he writes of fleeing Russia for my Africa. And note this theme of fleeing Russia. It would come up again in his life as well. In fact, he even began, though he never finished it, a story about his great ancestor, Hannibal. It would be called, this story was to be called, The Blackamoor of Peter the Great. Now, this complex heritage helped in many ways shape his complex self-identity as simultaneously an ancient Russian aristocrat, a really true Russian with roots in the old pre-Petrine Muscovy days, as a non-European outsider, a sort of double outsider, but also as a creation of the Europeanizing Peter the Great. And this duality, it's actually more than a duality, of being both insider and outsider, as well as a creation of Peter the Great trying to transform the country, was all visible in his life. Most obviously, he was a privileged insider in so many ways. In 1811, he left his native Moscow for St. Petersburg, for the capital, where he was enrolled in a new lycée, a very elite private school that was directly attached to the emperor's summer residence at Tsarskoye Selo, meaning Tsar's village, nothing village about it, a huge palace was there. And in fact, the school was directly attached to the palace by a little bridge, and the emperor would periodically cross this bridge just to see how the students in this special lycée were getting along. As a student, though, Pushkin preferred writing verses, drawing, fencing, he particularly liked, to really serious study. But his early verses, which he began already to write as a student, were already getting him an appreciate audience, even outside of the school. After graduating as a good son of the nobility, as an insider in the system, he was given a very good position at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It's clear, though, he had absolutely no interest in government service. The whole thing bored him, despite the noble traditions. This is what one was expected to do. But fortunately, the work was not particularly difficult, and it allowed him to do what he really loved. Enjoy life in St. Petersburg. He went to balls and the ballet and theater, and of course, time to do what he most loved, to write poetry. At the same time, we also see great evidence that Pushkin was already beginning to feel himself to be an outsider to this system, and in more profound ways than just his distaste for government work. He began to associate with literary circles that were increasingly talking about politics, and even to political societies, semi-legal, illegal entirely, that existed among the elites. In fact, it was in these societies that he became quite close friends with many of the people who would be involved in the 1825 Decembrist uprising. And it's clear that he shared many of their political and social attitudes. In fact, in this, what might be described as Pushkin's emerging Decembrist spirit, he even wrote a few mildly political poems about the glories of liberty and the like, which circulated hand to hand, couldn't possibly be published. He also liked to write, mainly for the entertainment of his friends, little satirical epigrams about various officials and even the Tsar himself. Now, the Tsar, Alexander I, learned about all this. Elite circles are not all that big in Russia at the time, and he was transferred as punishment out of the capital. Nonetheless, he kept writing, and although most of his works were not political at all, occasionally they were. Most troubling, in fact, to the establishment were that he added to this mix of slightly critical poems and writings attacks on the church itself. Like many educated Russians, he considered the church to be medieval and obscurantist and in no way fitting for a modern society. As a result of these daring, if really still rather modest, forays into the opposition, He was dismissed from the civil service entirely and forced into what amounted to house arrest on his estate. And this is where he was in 1825 when his friends attempted an armed rebellion. No one really knows whether Pushkin would have joined them, and had he joined them, been punished, as so many were, with exile to Siberia. In fact, legend has it that Nicholas at one point asked him to come and talk with him about his role in this rebellion, and asked him, said, Pushkin, would you have joined the Decemberist rebellion if you happened to be in Petersburg at the time? And Pushkin's answer, slightly enigmatic but nonetheless telling, was, they were my friends. We know, in fact, that his sympathies for this movement were clear, and he made this most explicit in a poem he wrote to the Decemberists who were in Siberian exile. Deep in the Siberian mine, he wrote, keep your patience proud. The bitter toil shall not be lost, the rebel thought unbowed. And he even goes on to predict the victory of the cause. The heavy clanging chains will fall, the walls will crumble in a word, and freedom greet you in the light, and brothers give you back the sword. In 1826, the new Tsar, Nicholas I, pardoned Pushkin, but in a way that reveals the persistent ambivalence of Pushkin's place and identity as insider and outsider. The emperor ordered Pushkin, under escort, to come back from his home in exile, to the capital and appear personally before him. This is the occasion in this famous conversation about whether he would have taken part in this rebellion. And Nicholas I also informed him, according to Pushkin's account of these discussions, that it was time for him to stop, in Nicholas's words, playing the fool. That's how Nicholas saw all of this political dissidence. And to ensure that Pushkin behaved, he was, after all, beginning to be too important a poet to allow to be an outsider, Nicholas declared that he would personally be Pushkin's censor. In fact, he was assigned a special official under the close watch of the Tsar, but he was so much an insider, but also so much a problem, that Nicholas declared he would be his own private censor. The results of this relationship were rather mixed. On the one hand, Pushkin did begin to stop playing the fool in some respects. His writings often praised Russia and its rulers, especially Peter the Great, who he greatly admired, but even occasionally the reigning monarch Nicholas I himself, which earned him great condemnation by some of his friends and other liberals. How dare he praise this horrible tyrant? Nonetheless, Pushkin also continued to write politically critical poems not for publication that would be distributed among his friends. In fact, even some of his greatest works, such as the epic poem about Peter the Great called The Bronze Horseman, named after the statue Catherine built in bronze to him on Senate Square in St. Petersburg. Even this was a work, as were others, which were filled with subtle and not so subtle warnings about the dangers of unbridled political power and arrogant political will. This poem in particular is about a great flood, indeed the very flood of 1824 that so troubled Alexander I, and about a suggestion of how even with mighty power, one cannot control everything, such as the elements. And when an ordinary man, suffering in this flood, curses the statue of Peter, he rises up off his great pedestal and chases this poor man through the city. A darker image of Peter I, it seems, emerging. There's even some evidence that in these years, Pushkin asked Nicholas's permission to leave the country, to emigrate, and moved to Western Europe, to flee, as it were, not for his Africa, but for his Europe. To go to the West, Nicholas I refused. And there are stories and evidence in the archives that he asked more than once to be allowed to leave the country. How do we make sense of all these contradictions? One view, the view offered by Soviet scholars, is that the true Pushkin was a rebel, a complete rebel, a Decembrist at heart, but had to pretend to be a loyalist in order not to be sent to Siberia, in order to protect his freedom, to allow him to write and even to publish. Another way to look at it is that both faces of Pushkin were true, were honest, that he was both a loyalist and a rebel, just as he was both a Russian and an African, both an aristocratic insider and a troublesome rebel. In other words, ambivalence was the ground on which he most often stood. And one could suggest that this very uncertainty was characteristic of what it meant to be an educated Russian in Russia of Nicholas I's reign. Now, to more fully understand Pushkin's peculiar identity, and most importantly, his place in his own time, one has to look a little bit more closely at Pushkin's style, his manner of living and writing. For Pushkin, one of the highest values was play. He loved to play. It pervaded everything he did, was central to his personality, and indeed, it should be said, was increasingly part of the westernized culture of 19th century Russia. In the lycée, in the school where he attended at Tsarskoye Selo, he had a reputation as a very creative young man, but flighty, foolish in some ways. Remember Nicholas I's comment about him. In fact, his best subjects were dancing, fencing, literature, and French. As a government official in St. Petersburg, as we've seen, he reveled in the pleasures of high society, as did many aristocratic and upper-class Russians of the time. He loved balls. He loved the ballet. He loved drunken parties with his friends. He loved to gamble, as so many of his class did, and in fact lost thousands at cards, soon going very deep into debt. And especially, he often said, he loved women. For example, he wrote in 1819 to a friend that two of the greatest things about living in St. Petersburg were champagne and women. And even better, he said, in Petersburg, there's plenty of both. To some degree, this is a pose, the sort of pose of the aristocratic rake, very characteristic of the time, but it was also, to some extent, the life he chose to live. He finally married, at the age of 31, to an 18-year-old woman who everyone said was the most dazzling beauty in St. Petersburg. And at this point, he wrote to a friend that while he loved her greatly, it's worth noting that she was, his words, the 113th love of my life. Again, a pose, but telling. Most importantly, Pushkin's literary writing, so influential, so popular, also reflected this culture of play. First of all, it reflected it quite literally. For example, in his famous novel in verse, Eugene Onegin, Yevgeny Onegin, begins with a detailed and truly loving description of the pleasures of city life, especially in St. Petersburg. Strasbourg pâté, dancers' feet, French champagne, books, elegant clothing, and all the rest of the glories of physical, indulgent life in the capital. All this weaves through the whole poem, in fact. Secondly, and perhaps even more essential, his writing itself was deliberately playful. He explicitly rejected any notion that there ought to be high seriousness in poetry, or so he continually said publicly. For example, in 1825, he was corresponding with somebody about one of the poems that he had recently written called The Gypsies, and he responds as follows. He said, "You ask me, what is the aim of poetry? Good Lord, the aim of poetry is poetry." And this was reflected in his writing, which was exceptionally versatile, playful, creative, imaginative. He wrote, in fact, in virtually every known style throughout Europe and developed others of his own. He wrote epics. He wrote satirical ditties. And his tone of voice shifted back and forth from poem to poem and even within individual poems. At one moment, he wrote with great high seriousness, with bloody banners and dead horses on the field. At another, he wrote with witty mockery or even a little bit of mild obscenity. Sometimes he bared his soul deeply. Other times he was quite distant and aloof. In fact, lots of literary critics have talked about his style of writing as protean, as shifting, as open-ended, as in constant flux. In a word, and this is